And so what we're going to do today is I'm going to review the Ashtekar formulation. This is what we did last time. I'm just going to put the formulas on the board. Ashtekar formulation of GR, of general relativity, and its relation to BF theory. Then we're going to review the Dirac program for quantization of constrained systems. And then we're going to talk about quantum general relativity. Taking the basics of the approach, which is sometimes called loop quantum gravity. Now, let me emphasize, our goal is to set up the basics of the quantization of general relativity and other theories in order to then discuss the various issues that arise having to do with the problem of time. So we could do this in different theories, we could do this with different formalisms, but since this is the one where the results have gotten the furthest and they're really the most results on relevant for what we want to talk about, we'll talk about this one. But much of what we're going to be saying is not special for loop quantum gravity. But while we're here, we're going to introduce it. Okay. Any questions from last time? Okay. So let me remind everybody of the setup, which we've come a long way in the last lectures. We went through a lot of material, some pretty intricate. Let me emphasize that where we come out is not very complicated. So we have some compact manifold sigma, which we're going to take to be compact and without a boundary, because there are special issues that arise when there is a boundary and boundary conditions and boundary observables and so forth. They're not relevant for the problem of cosmology where there is no boundary. And we have on this is a spatial manifold. So we're going to take its dimension is the dimension of space, whatever it is in the theory we're interested in. If I don't otherwise say it's three, but of course there are special cases where people are interested in other dimensions. On this manifold, we have a connection, which is given by a one-form valued in some group. And we're going to take the group to be SU2, or a complexification of it. I'll be more specific about that in a little while. And we have a conjugate momentum field that we've been calling pi, but I'm going to change notation because it's a pretty universal change in notation. And call it E. So I'm on what we call pi AI. I hope nobody minds too much we call E. E stands for electric field. And it's just that the literature in the subject uses E much more than it uses pi. And I don't usually have a glass of wine with the lecture, we'll see how it goes. Okay. Then we have the Poisson brackets, AAI at a point X on the manifold, EBJ, the point Y on the manifold, is delta BA, delta IJ, delta 3 X and Y. And everything we said about density still holds. So E is really a vector density. So it has a twiddle. And delta is the delta function, which is a density on its section index, as we discussed before. So there's no metric, no other structure. And the Hamiltonian is a sum of constraints. And so those are the kinds of theories that we're interested in. We're interested in gauge theories with no background structure, with no prior metric, on a spatial manifold where the Hamiltonian is just proportional to constraints. Now, we've been studying two examples of this kind of theory. In the first, which is BF theory, the constraints are Gauss's law. So, and the indices I, J, K, etc. always refer to the group, the generators of the group. Oh, and we use the same letter for Gauss's law. Oh, well, okay. GI, it has the form of the covariant derivative of E in the, with the group value of index I is equal to zero. And let me emphasize, this connection is just a gauge covariant connection. So if we write this out, it's del A E A I plus epsilon I J K A J A each little A K in the case of S U 2. So this derivative term is an ordinary derivative on a vector density. And let me emphasize that that is well defined completely without there having to be a metric or a covariant derivative. If this was not a density, it would not be well defined. And the reason is that E twiddle A can be thought of as dual to a two form. I'll call the two form EBC. And then this object here is really DE written as a two form. ABC, the dual of that, which is, which means that you multiply by epsilon ABC. In other words, this is well-defined Cartan differential operator on differential forms, and is well-defined even in the absence of a metric. Then, in BF theory, there are three of these constraints, and there were a bunch of other constraints, which were written FABI, which were the ordinary Yang-Mills field strength of A minus a constant, which was the cosmological constant, epsilon ABC ECI equals zero. And there are 3 times 3 is 9 of these, but actually 6 of them are equal to these, which you can tell if you take the covariant divergence of this. So there are actually 6 constraints. Okay, does everybody remember this? Now, by contrast, in the Ashtekar formulation, the constraints are related but different. The first of all is the Gauss's law constraints for the group SU2. And then, if you recall, instead of these, we take 4 of these. These are 9 constraints. We take 4 of them. And the 4 we take are the object we call del EA, which is FABI EBI. And the constraint C, which is, let me remember how I want to write this. I'm going to write it in the following way, EAI EEJ, I'm going to pull out an epsilon IJK, and then this is times FABK, minus or plus, somebody should remind me, I think it's plus lambda times epsilon ABC EDK. And this, we call this the diffeomorphism constraint. And this the Hamiltonian constraint. Okay, so those are two theories whose quantization we're interested in. They're both defined on a three-dimensional manifold with no metric and no other structure. Okay, so any questions about what these are the theories of interest? Okay, and we went through a discussion about how this really represents general relativity. If you go through that discussion in a little bit more detail, there are factors of I and of Newton's constant that appear at various places. So I think I'm not going to derive those, but what I'm going to do is just mention what is the connection to what are usually called ABM or Arnold-Wittgenstein variables. And if you don't know what those are, I'll tell you. They are the standard canonical variables. So the standard canonical variables in general relativity, you start with a four metric. And you split it up. You split up the world into surfaces of constant time for any value of a time coordinate. So you do what's called a 3 plus 1 splitting, giving you these spatial slices, sigma. The 4 metric then pulls back to give a 3 metric, which is called Q, and is the spatial metric of those spatial slices. And its canonical momenta, so if you decompose the action principle for general relativity in such a way as to make the three metric the configuration variable, then its canonical momenta is called pi ab. And pi ab is related to the square root of the determinant of q times the time derivative of q, of course, with raising some indices. Plus other terms, but it is a momenta in the traditional sense that the Poisson brackets here are q, a, b, and x. Pi, and pi is again the density, cd at y, are delta ab, sorry, delta ac, delta bd, delta 3 xy. So in the old Arnold-Wittgenstein-Misner picture, the way that general relativity was understood dynamically is that you had a three-dimensional geometry which was evolving in time, and the three-dimensional geometry had a velocity, and it had a momenta, just like fields, just like scalar fields, electromagnetic fields, and so forth, have momenta. Now, then there are the analogous constraints. There's actually not a Gauss's law constraint because there's no local Lorentz invariance, there is a diffeomorphism in constraint and a Hamiltonian constraint. Since I don't need it, I won't write them. What I will write is the translation. Let's see. So the translation is that if you take two electric fields and you trace on the internal or the angles the SD2 indices, you get an object which is proportional to the inverse of the Klee metric, but it has density weight 2 because this is a density and this is a density. So that's multiplied by the determinant of the metric with the indices downstairs. And then the A, which is the SU2 connection in the Ashikar sense. Remember when we derived it from Palatini, it was complexified, has a real part, which is essentially the Christoffel symbol of Q, with some indices renamed. And then I times the conjugate momenta again with the indices renamed, and to get rid of the density weights, you have to divide by determinant Q. And one more factor is that Newton's constant goes right there, and I believe 1 over g squared there. So that in terms of dimensions, G times A has dimensions of 1 over lambda, which is Newton's constant. Now, I'm not deriving those for you, but that's actually what was the outcome of Ashikar's construction. And it can be, these relations can be derived. Okay, let me just make a couple of comments. One of them many apologies. I'm not going to put the G there. I'm just going to put a 1 over G. And I apologize. I know that was not consistent. 1 over G there. And so A has dimensions of 1 over length. I apologize. A has dimensions of 1 over length. But this is the way I want it. And then there is a G here, it turns out, in the Poisson brackets. And there is also an I here in the Poisson brackets. And one thing that you can check pretty easily is that the Poisson bracket of A with E are compatible with the Poisson brackets of Q and pi, given these relations. Okay. At least if somebody checks and they don't come out right, then please tell me that I missed some factors. There are different conventions as to where you put the Newton's constant, and I'm going to prefer to keep it like that. Why this G is here is that we should have started out the action as the thing we started out, B wedge F, should have had a 1 over G here for dimensional reasons. And this, so therefore, B over G turns into a canonical momenta. And when you shake that out, then it turns out to be a G in the Poisson bracket. Okay. A couple of comments on things that you need to know about and look out for, and then we'll get actually to the quantization. One of them is that in the case where there is a Euclidean signature, then this I and this I are not present. So if you want to consider general relativity with the Euclidean signature as a dynamical system, you also get a Hamiltonian system. And the difference from the usual Lorentzian signature is that the sign that I here and here are one. And that means that the group really is SU2, that is the real group. Whereas in this case, because of the I here and the I here, this A really lives in a complexification of SU2. So in the rest of the case, we have to be careful about that. In the Lorentzian case, A lives in the complexification of SU2. And then in the Lorentzian case, one has to supplement the theory so far with reality conditions. That is, if the natural thing to do would just be to consider A is complex and their conjugate momenta E is complex, and that will give you the complexification of the Einstein equations. To get the real version of the Einstein equations, then you have to supplement the equations of motion with so-called reality conditions. And there are several different ways of writing them. One way is to say that Q is real. So Q is, let's see, we use bar for that, which in the way that I've written things also means that the coefficients E are real. And then what you want is to have the conjugate momenta of the three metric be real, which means that you really need time to be real. And so the way that you can write that is you can say that A plus its complex conjugate is the Christoffel symbol, which is a function of Q. And so the idea of these reality conditions is that if these conditions are imposed on initial data, they're preserved. So that what you get when you evolve from initial data that satisfies these conditions is a Lorentzian manifold, which is a real Lorentzian spacetime. And we're going to want to pay attention to how these are realized in the quantum theory. In the Euclidean theory, everything is trivial, everything is real, A is real, and E is real, and there's nothing complicated. You notice that this condition here is rather complicated, and that becomes an issue later on. Okay. One more thing. In fact, let me see how I want to say this. By the way, I'm still. Yeah, no, that's. Excuse me, the G is always here with the I. Let me apologize. I was asking you all to check that. Since Ashtekar's first discussion of this, it was noticed first by Barbero, that I could take, do something else, which is take Lorentzian general relativity and simply cross out the I here. And if I crossed out the I here as well, I would have the same theory. That is, I would have the same correspondence with the real Lorentzian case. So there arises what are sometimes called Barbero or Ashkar-Barbero variables, which is where one takes A is gamma plus G times pi E, I won't write the rest of the indices, with no I there. And then the advantage of that is that the reality conditions are simple. The reality conditions are that the A's are real. And the group is just the real part of SU2. So you can have real variables to describe Lorentzian general relativity. And the same Poisson brackets, and this is something that is non-trivial that you have to check. What you have to check is that the Poisson brackets of A, all the different components of A, are zero, even if you take out that coefficient there. And you can check that. So so everything looks the same, except this I is gone, and this I is gone. And that's a great advantage, and it's used in many versions of the theory. What you lose when you do this is the interpretation of the A that, a very nice geometrical interpretation. What you lose is the interpretation that A is the left-handed part of the space-time connection, which is, remember how we derived it by going to Palatini, having the Palatini connection, then splitting it into a left-handed part and a right-handed part. In the Lorentzian case, that split into left-handed, right-handed, or self-dual, and anti-self-dual requires the complexification of SU2 and requires the I here. So if you cross out the I, you have a variable which has many of the same properties, but it's no longer, its field strength, for example, is no longer the self-dual part of the curvature tensor in the sense which is usually studied in general relativity. So there is a price that you pay for removing this. And consequently, there is another price that you pay, which is that the Hamiltonian constraint gets another term. So in this case, the Hamiltonian constraint is what it is of Ashtakar plus a new term, which I'm not going to be writing now. It is still a simple term to write, and one can compute with it, but the theory is slightly more complicated. I'm saying these things for completeness because if you study the literature, if you approach the literature, different things come up. Much of the literature in the quantum gravity is now based on the Ashtakar-Barbero connection and is not based on the original Ashtakar connection. And so you should be careful when you see results and you study papers exactly what they're doing. Now, this gives rise to the famous Immerzi parameter. That is, when people find it useful to put a parameter here. And this parameter, in general, could be complex. And that would allow you to talk about all of these cases by the choice of that parameter. And so the parameter goes here, and it goes here. And it's called the Immerzi parameter, just to show that we all have our Italian pronunciation. And we like Giorgio Immerzi, who was the person who introduced it. OK. The Immerzi parameter, as you see, its real part multiplies Newton's constant, so there's a sense in which its real part can be seen as a kind of a normalization of Newton's constant. It has a quantum mechanical significance, which I'll be mentioning in a little while when we get to it. Yes?
Its modulus deserves to be scaled up to this
function. It's what?
The mod of gamma.
The mod, yes, the modulus of gamma. Yeah. And like any good parameter, it has its own literature about it, its various properties. Okay. I'm trying not to embarrass myself now, so let's see if this works. Good. Okay, so any questions? That's the summary of the Ashtekar formulation. Yes.
So are there any kind of observational consequences from the value of the multiple parameter?
There are in the quantum mechanically.
But not just this.
We'll get there. What does?
Not classically.
I think not classically for the following reason. Classically, its modulus is just a rescaling of Newton's constant, and its phase is just a choice of different variables which may or may not be of interest. So I don't think classically it is observable. There are claims in the literature that when you couple to fermions, it has observable consequences, and I don't believe those claims classically.
So,
but it would take us too far aside to explain that.
So, but then you have basically one parameter family of quantum theories which correspond to the classical theory?
Yes. Yes. Okay. And I will be making a formal statement of why that's true. Okay? Because there is actually a reason for that. Okay.
Sorry. So, the group in the Lorentzian case is not compact.
Yes. Yes.
And here we're dealing somehow with a compact group.
Here, that is in the Ashtekar-Rivero group. Yes.
So, is the non-compactness still there somehow, but just push it into some other place?
Well, what this is that if I give a time-like vector in a Lorentz frame, so I give a direction of time, then I pick out a free space, which is perpendicular to T, and A Barbero is the projection, I'm not going to write all the symbols because I'm not going to write it correctly, but it's the projection of the space-time Lorentzian connection into that, let's call that, let's give that free space a name, S, into S. If there's a half Lorentzian connection, I pick a direction of time. There's an SU2 subgroup that commutes with it. It's compact. And this is the projection of the connection into that subspace. And that's well defined. And that, once you show that it has the same Poisson brackets up to factors of I, it's good enough.
So you're saying you don't lose any important information about that projection?
No. What you dynamically, to get the evolution right, you now have to add a new term to the Hamiltonian system, which is not that complicated, but I'm not going to write it right now. So it's completely equivalent. Okay. So last time, at the end of last time, I talked about the Dirac procedure. And the idea of the Dirac procedure is that we find, loosely speaking, some kinematical Hilbert space of states, which is a representation of some kinematical algebra. The idea is there's the phase space algebra, that's, you know, all functions of A and E make an algebra under Poisson bounded. And the phase space algebra, you want to have some closed subalgebra. And I'll give that a name A. And that has to be selected. It should be some subalgebra of the phase space algebra. And you want to find a representation of it in some algebra A hat of operators on a Hilbert space. That's the first step. And so we call this the kinematical algebra. We call this the kinematical operator algebra, the kinematical Hilbert space. The next step is going to be to formulate the constraints as a subspace, that to formulate the constraints as operators and project down. Now, the idea, the basic idea of the loop representation is to try to make, is to make sense of the following idea. Usually, one takes for the kinematical, the canonical algebra, the one used in canonical quantization, which, let me just give that a symbol. Let me just point to it. That would be this. This is the canonical. Algebra. And the canonical algebra has representations that have been very well studied, which are Fock spaces. But the Fock space depends on a background metric. When you take, when you construct a quantum field theory through the Fock space, you need a background metric, and you need it in several places. I'm not going to go through the procedure, but you need, if you go through the procedure carefully, of constructing a Fock space for a scalar field theory or any other quantum field theory, you find you need a background metric, and you also need a choice of time. Because, so in finding the Fock space representation of the canonical algebra, you need a background metric, and you need a choice of time. And the reason is that you treat negative frequency fields differently than positive frequency fields when you construct the Fock space. And to do that, you have to know who is a negative frequency field and who is a positive frequency field. And that's not invariant under different choices of times. It happens to be invariant in a flat space quantum field theory under different choices of times related by Poincaré or Lorentz transformations, but it's not invariant under any larger group of transformations. So this didn't seem to be an option. And therefore, we had the following idea, and it's really just two ideas at the same time, related to each other. So one of them is that Chris Eichem was emphasizing around this time that for certain reasons it might be important to make quantum gravity by taking for the kinematical algebra, not the canonical algebra, not the canonical commutation relations, but some other nonlinear functions of those. And so that idea was around. And actually, the reasons why Chris was emphasizing that were not realized in his program, but I might as well emphasize them. Chris was realizing, Chris's argument was that the you should want to maintain the condition of the determinant of the metric is always positive, and that the representation theory of the canonical algebra, that is this algebra, didn't naturally include the condition that the determinant of the metric was positive. And so Chris had an argument that one should take another approach. And that was the motivation. It is not realized, as you'll see in this, but it was motivation. Another motivation came from Polyakov and other people, Wilson, Mandelstam, in the study of gauge theories, because there was and is a conjecture that the right coordinates, the right observables, fields, coordinates, to construct quantum gauge theories are not the A's, but are the functions of A's that we call the Wilson loops. The trace of the path ordered product of B to the integral A that D gamma around the loop. Let me not call it, I'm going to be in a horrible situation, and let me call this alpha around the loop. And that's the pathway, which we discussed that object before. And there was and is an argument that these are the fundamental variables to study if you want to study a quantum gauge theory. And it's interesting to notice that these are all ordinarily gauge invariant to start with. That is, they automatically solve the Gauss law constraint, which generates ordinary SU2 gauge transformations. So what happened was that we had the idea that we could realize Chris Isham's idea by constructing an algebra in which these were some of the kinematical algebra. There also have to be momentum variables. I'll come to that in a minute. But that the kinematical algebra would be based on the Wilson loops, and that would capture the wisdom that Polyakov was arguing for and the wisdom that Isham was arguing for. So that was kind of the motivation, the background for this. Let me add that there's no reason not to put a little parameter there. And that's what the inertia parameter does for us. It is actually a one-parameter family of variables you might choose to employ. Okay, now there are two ways to proceed to capture the momentum variables, and I'm going to talk about one of them, but they're equally good. One of them is called the little T algebra. And the other one is called the loop strip algebra. I guess for sign, I'm only going to talk about one of them. And it's a little bit more, the presentation is a little bit more compact. We talked about these. So we want to get some functions of the momentum variables into our algebra. So in other words, this algebra of functions consists of all the Wilson loops of all the loops in the three manifold, the d-dimensional manifold. And of course, they all commute with each other. So those make us commuting our C-star algebra under a certain norm and so forth. We want to get a momentum variable. And one way to do it is to take a loop and take a point on that loop, which we can consider to be the base point. So gamma of 0 equals p. And then we take the conjugate momentum or electric field at that base point. We take the parallel transport u gamma around the loop, and we trace them. And so that's a linear function of the momentum, and that we call TA, and it's notated almost like the Wilson loop. It's a function of a loop. And it's a function of a tangent vector. Or it is a vector at the base point of the loop. Okay, so is that clear? So it's, what's nice about it is it's also gauge invariant. That is, under the gauge transformations generated by the Gauss's law, I can just put these here. Just remind everybody. Under the gauge transformation generated by the Gauss's law, so delta, say, FA is the covariant derivative of F, which is the Poisson bracket of A with the Gauss's law of F, and the same thing, delta F of E is epsilon ijk, whoops, I'm getting sloppy, epsilon ijk E k a f j. Under both of those transformations, the Wilson loops are invariant, and these objects are invariant. That is to say, if here is the phase space of E and A, and here is the constraint surface just for the Gauss's law constraint G equals 0, then the T's, the Wilson loops in these T, we call these T1s. They have one index there. These T1s parameterize or coordinatize the constraint surface. Okay. And it's straightforward to show that the algebra closes. You need to remember, and I think we discussed this. I'll write it down and tell me if we discussed this. That the Poisson bracket of the Wilson loop of, say, a loop alpha with E A at a point Y is E A I is the integral. So this is, here we have some loop alpha, and here we have a point Y, where the electric field may be, and what we get is an integral around the loop, so integral ds. There's an alpha dot A of S. There's a delta 3 that says that it's 0 unless the point alpha of S around the loop is the point Y where the electric field sits. And then there's the trace of the parallel transport starting at the point S. If it does sit there, it sits there at some point S. That is, if the electric field is on the loop, it's there at some point S. And U gamma of s is, we defined before, the parallel transport around the loop beginning and ending at the point s times the generator of su2 tau r. I think we derived that before. That's the same thing as d by d a a I at x of the Wilson loop t of alpha. Did we derive that? Does anybody remember that? Let me make it an exercise. It's much easier than it looks to derive that. The point is, obviously, the Poisson bracket of a function of A on the loop with a momentum off the loop is going to be zero. So you have to have a delta function. And in any case, it's not difficult to just do the computation. So then, from that, it's just a step to do the computation of the Poisson bracket of the T1 with the T0, the Wilson loop, which is sometimes called the T0. The n, that is the 1, the 0, refers to the number of electric fields which are inserted in the loop. So if I have a loop alpha and another loop beta, then, and I want to take the Poisson bracket of T of alpha with TA of beta, the result is going to be zero unless the base point here of the loop carrying the T1 is also on the other loop. So, and if it is, so one is going to get the same prefactor, that is the integral of ds around the loop alpha, alpha dot a of s. And notice here that the tangent vector index picks up the index from the electric field, which is an upper index. And it's a vector density, and the delta function here soaks up the density part. So this is as before, delta 3 of alpha of s, now the base point p. If it does pick it up, then what you have is the trace of u alpha at that point s extracted by a Pauli matrix, and then the trace of u beta also most traced against a Pauli matrix. And then there's an identity that says that if I have two SU2 matrices, trace of A against the Pauli matrix times trace of B against the Pauli matrix is the trace of A times B minus the trace of A times B inverse, which is an identity, again, you can check. And therefore, this is just this expression, integral ds, alpha dot a of s, delta 3, alpha of s, p, times trace of u alpha mu beta minus the trace. And a trace of u alpha u beta is just the Wilson loop of the loop alpha beta combined. And they intersect at one point here, so it's clear what you mean by combining the loops alpha and beta. at the base point P minus the Wilson loop of the loop alpha theta inverse. And finally, I forgot the factors of I times Newton's constant times the inertia parameter, which go always everywhere. So what we've done is shown that the commutator of these new objects, T1, with the Wilson loop is again a linear combination of Wilson loops. So the algebra is closing. This is a non-trivial property. You start out with this object, which is linear in momentum. In some sense, it has to happen that way, because you take a Poisson bracket, you get rid of this momenta or electric field, and then it's just a function of parallel transport. So if it's gauge invariance, it's a function of the traces of parallel transport, so it has to end up a function of Wilson loops, and indeed it does. The next thing, and I'll leave it as an exercise, is to show that the Poisson bracket of two of these momentum objects, TA, TB, is a linear combination of such objects. And it's basically the same calculation again with another E stuck in it. So I'll leave that as an exercise. So we have a closed algebra, and it's an algebra of functions on the constraint surface for Gauss's law. So what we've done in this case is what I said usually cannot be done, which is solve the constraint, find an algebra of functions on the constraint surface, and then work from now on with that algebra. But that's what we're going to be doing. So we never again need consider a non-gauge invariant expression. Every expression from now on is gauge invariant. The other constraints are gauge invariant. The Hamiltonian is gauge invariant. The observables are gauge invariant. So one is now in a world where one just doesn't have to worry about the ordinary SU2 gauge transformations again. If one can find a representation of this algebra. Okay. So if we follow the Dirac procedure, what we need to do now we modified the Dirac procedure as this first step. What we need to do now is find a representation of this algebra. And work with that representation of that algebra, and see if we can bring to that representation all the gauge invariant functions we need to define the theory, for example, the remaining constraints. And the answer is that we can do that. And that's why this quantization program succeeds. Okay, so let me ask if there are any questions up to this point. What I'm now going to do is discuss two representations of this algebra. And I guess I forgot to write the trivial part. So Wilson loops, this should be a Poisson bracket, commute with Wilson loops because they're all just functions of A which commute with each other. So we have a commuting algebra of coordinates. We have momentum variables, and they commute on coordinates to give coordinates and momentum variables, have Poisson brackets which give further momentum variables. Okay, so any questions? Let me also specify, let me simplify our life in the representation theory for a little bit. And let's take SE2 real, which means that we don't have to worry about this I. And the gate, the A's live in just compact real SE2. Okay, although what I'm about to say can be extended. In the case of, what's nice about the case of real SU2 is that you can show that the trace of the Wilson loops are bounded. They're bounded between 2 and minus 2. So they're nice bounded variables. Okay. So let me give you a representation of these operators on a Hilbert space. So here's my Hilbert space. I'm going to consider functions of the connection that are of particular form. And the particular form is a countable sum of terms, each of which has some coefficients. And each term is a product of a finite number of Wilson loops of loops. So I imagine I take a finite number of loops, and I multiply their Wilson loop functions together. And then I consider linear combinations of those, countable linear combinations of those. And this is a Hilbert space. And I actually have to do a little work to tell you what the norm is on the Hilbert space. So I'm going to do that. Let me consider, it's a No, thank you for the question. The Hilbert space is far from separable. The uncomfortableness of that will be removed when we apply the Dirac procedure at the next step and go down to the diffeomorphism invariant states when it will become separable. Okay, but thank you for that. That's an important question. So let me consider a state which is a single term of that. A single term of that gives me some set of loops, and these loops, the complexity of the problem comes from the fact that these loops may intersect, they may share some edge. So for each term, there's a little lattice, which I'll call L of that set of loops. For each term, there's a set of loops. And there's a lattice that we get made with that set of loops, which again, we're being careful about intersections and tracings together and things like that. Now, when I do that, this lattice is the disjoint union of a bunch of segments, which I'm going to label capital I. Yes, here's segment 1, here's segment 2, here's segment 3, and so forth. Okay. Now, that's a lattice, and I'm going to define what's a lattice gauge theory. And I hope that this doesn't feel like we're going out of our way, but it is part of the complete definition, and we need this. We define an SU2 lattice gauge theory on a given lattice L. For example, this lattice made from the intersections of these loops, which is a disjoint union of some segments. A configuration is an element of SU2 for each segment. So an SU2 element for each segment. So that's a little subpiece of the configuration space. It's a little bit bigger than the configuration space because I haven't required the functions just to be gauge invariant. But given some set of alphas of loops, I take the union of the T of those alphas, and that lives in this configuration space. Because there's some, if I divide it up, there's going to be some products of holonomies on this segment, some products of holonomies on this segment, some products of holonomies on this segment. I'm just being careful about how all those divide up. So for example, I'm taking a loop which might have done that, and I'm saying that loop is divided into a segment, a segment, a segment, a segment. And I'm writing the holonomy as the product of the SU2 elements on those segments. And is it clear? It's a little bit intricate what I'm doing, but the point is that in lattice gauge theory is an invariant measure. So there's an invariant norm on this configuration space. And that's what I'm about to write down. And that's why I'm taking the trouble. So on any lattice, there's a configuration space of the lattice. And a typical function in it is a function of the parallel transports on a different segment. And there's a norm on the space of functions, which are the product over the segments of the integral over the group. So there's an SU2 group at each segment. There's a particular group invariant measure called the Haar measure. So I have a function of group elements on these different segments, and the norm is defined by integrating over this group invariant measure on each of those segments. And this is an object which is known to particle physicists and condensed matter physicists from the studies of lattice gauge theory. So it's a very physical object. Let me give some examples of computations. Well, let me state the main thing. The main result is that the norm on this big Hilbert space is gotten by taking the sum of the norms on each of these factors. So given this, I let me rearrange my space a little bit so I can say that nicely. So if I have some psi of the t's constructed as above, its norm which is a complex number, is the sum, and I'm referring to that sum, of the sets of loops of the norm of the function. For each set of loops, there's a lattice. And I get a function on the lattice defined, as I did here, by products of the SU2 elements. And that gives me a norm on these states. And then you can show that this is a Hilbert space, and the normalizable states, since these are all bounded, are that the absolute value squared of these are finite. So that defines the Hilbert space. In other words, your quantum gravity researcher, for every state, since there's a countable sum of terms, and every term refers to a lattice I can write down, and then I call up my friend the lattice gauge theory and ask me how to take the norm of each term. And that defines for me an inner product. What I've said is much fancier than maybe needs be, but it's the precise way to say it. Well, it's an approximation of the precise way to say it. And now I just need to tell you how to find a representation of operators that correspond to Wilson loops and these momentum operators. So this is much easier. I want an operator which corresponds to a Wilson loop variable of gamma. I want to evaluate that on a state. That is some function of, in each term, of some number of Wilson loops, of sets, products, and sums of sets of Wilson loops. And this is defined to be just multiply the value of psi, which is some complex number evaluated on some set of loops, by the Wilson loop of this additional loop. So this is the analog of the operator for x just multiplies. So the Wilson loops act like multiplication operators, just like position operators. And then the operator for the momenta, which is a function of some other loop alpha, acting on psi of this form, does the following. It performs the sum. Let me call this loop A, though. Let me use a symbol I haven't used before. And on each term, it asks the question, are these loops that this term has support of, do any of them go through the base point of the loop eta? So the way you do that is you sum over all those terms. You take the product over the loops in each term. You take the little factor. Which asks whether the point alpha of s of the alpha loop is the same as the base point p of the object that we're representing. And if it is, then we have a non-zero term. If it is, it's for a particular, so I've dropped some indices. This is the I's are labeling the terms. And I'm using the alphas, the loops, to label themselves. And then I have T of eta combined with alpha of I, that if it's a non-zero term, it's because this base point P of the loop eta found a loop that it goes through, and then you can combine it with that other loop in two different ways, and you take the difference. And that's the action. So the action, now, in a naive way, I could have computed this by acting naively and working in some naive, not very well-defined function space of size of A, but this is the way to give it a precise definition. And again, there's a factor of Green's constant and the emergency parameter there. So these are the definitions of the Hilbert space. And I said a lot of words, but basically, this is a Hilbert space which are functions of the connection on a manifold, which are a small set of such possible functions. It's spanned by all the possible products of finite numbers of Wilson loops in the manifold for finite sets of loops. And in that Hilbert space, these define operators in which you can check form a representation. And of course, there's an IH bar there, which is what makes it quantum mechanics, as part of the definition, that these form a representation of the Poisson brackets that we computed in the classical sign. Okay, questions?
Yeah. Wait, you defined a norm, but what was the inner product?
I was just being dumb. But, the norm is the inner products. So, if I want to know the inner product of a state, I mean I want the norm of the state times its complex conjugate, like that. So I multiply, I take the complex conjugate, I multiply by the state, I expand in terms of products of Wilson loops, and then I take the norm. Sorry, for not to say that. I think I made it sound a little technical. If you...
Do you mean that the inner product is psi star psi? I don't know if I'm listening to you.
Oh, this is the, yeah, sorry, I know what you're, let me try again. I have two states, psi and chi, okay. I take psi complex conjugate, multiply it by chi. I still have a function of A in the same function space, and I take it somewhere else. Apologies. Okay. And again, I made it sound complicated. The intuition is that we're taking a special set of functions of a connection, which are gauge invariant, which are constructed from a basis where each basis element is roughly products of Wilson loops of a bunch of loops. Now, this is inequivalent to the Fock space, which is a representation of the usual canonical Poisson brackets. And it's not difficult to show that this representation is unitarily inequivalent to a Fock representation. And for one thing, one way you can tell is that to define this representation, I have not had to specify a metric, and I have not had to specify a time coordinate or a notion of positive frequency or negative frequency. As was pointed out, This is a non-separable Hilbert space. I haven't yet displayed a basis. I'm about to display a basis, but it's not going to be a countable basis. And you might beat me up about that. And then my defense is going to be, A, this provides a passage to a space of different morphism and invariant states, which is separable. And my further line of defense is going to be the famous loss theorem from 2003, that under certain technical assumptions, this is the only quantization procedure that provides a route to a Hilbert space of different morphism and invariant states.
What determines whether that is complex, the Hilbert space?
These coefficients can be complex numbers. Yeah. All of if now it happens in the case of SU2, all of these functions of A are real. The traces of SU2 matrices are no, I'm sorry, I'm lying, that's not true. I apologize. I think that's right. Like the traces of SU2 matrices are not real. Does anybody know? Let's check it out at the break. Can I go a little bit further before we take a break? Okay. I just want to display a basis, an orthonormal basis. And then we can take a break. So it's useful to have an orthonormal basis. And it's sufficient to give an orthonormal basis for this function space on any graph. So I started with loops. I made a graph alpha by their support, L by their support. But it's enough to talk about the configuration space of any lattice L. So again, this lattice consists of a bunch of segments and nodes. So there's some segments Si and nodes and alpha which join to make a graph. Again, my configuration space is the space of SU2 elements on each edge. And here's a basis. Under that norm, label each edge by a half integer, j, k, l, m, n, which are labels of representations of SU2. And this generalizes standing group directly. But I'll talk about it in the case of SU2. And then I'm going to need it. Those are not the only labels, but I'm going to consider the following. Given that data, I consider I can consider the parallel transport along the segment S, so that's US, in the jth representation, as the path order e to the integral along the segment, so ds of a along the segment, but where I take the generators in the jth representation. So the result is a matrix which lives in the jth representation. So then I can consider a function, which I'm going to call t, which is a function of the u's. It's labeled by the j's, giving a representation label to each edge. I write down the product of all of these along the segments. And then I have a whole lot of indices, because for each segment, I have a matrix in a particular representation. So now I have to, so I have some indices, let me call it I, in the index, in the representation J at the segment S, and J in the representation, I know this is horrible, okay, I'll call it K, in the representation J of the segment S. And I have the product of these, and I have to tie them together. Now, what I tie them together with is in invariant tensors at the nodes. So I look at the nodes, and I have a set of representations, J, K, L, M, say, coming into or incident on a particular node. And I'd like to have an invariant object which, given group elements in each of these representations, gives me an invariant. And such an object is called by physicists a channel and by mathematicians an intertwiner. That is, what I want is an object I'll call it U, which lives in the space where I take the representation RJ cross RK cross RL cross RM and gives me an invariant. In that representation. And there may be no way to do that, there may be one way to do that, there may be a finite set of ways to do that as a function of what these representations are. And this is what one studies in quantum mechanics under addition of angular momentum. If one has one way to do this, it will be a function of the different matrix representations. And I think I'll say this in words before I try to write it down. What I'll try to do is write down examples. For every node, so you have a product over nodes, and for every node, you have an invariant which has the appropriate indices which ties up invariantly the group elements in their representation incident on that node. Rather than inventing a whole notation for that, I think everybody's getting tired, so I'll just finish the statement, take a break. So for each node, there is a label which is one of these objects which are called channels or intertwiners, and these functions are labeled by those as well. In other words, given the graph and a set of representations on the graphs and a set of channels, that is ways to take products of representations and extract invariants, I get a functions of group elements on the graph which are invariant, which are gauge invariant. And so it turns out that all such states are orthonormal under the inner product that I defined, and they make a complete basis for the space of states under the product that I defined. So what becomes of interest is graphs whose edges are labeled by representations and whose nodes are labeled by invariants and products of representations. And such graphs are called spin networks. And so this is the spin network's basis for this Hilbert space that I defined, which is to say, if I want a basis, now what I've told you about is a basis for each graph. What I then have to do is consider a limit of products of these for larger and larger graphs, and that I'm not going to define carefully, but it's defined carefully in the literature. In any case, it's clear so I'm not going to prove that this gives an orthonormal basis, but it's clear that it's not a separable basis, because if I consider two states this defined by a graph, and the other one defined, in which I just changed one loop by an arbitrarily small amount, then you can show that the states on the two graphs are orthogonal. That is, any state on one graph and any state on any other graph that is not precisely the same graph is orthogonal. And that means that there's an uncountable number of basis elements because there's an uncountable number of embeddings of any graph in three-dimensional space. So this is not a separable basis. And in fact, there is no separable basis. OK, questions? Questions out there in Western? OK, let's break for 15 minutes and come back. Thank you.